For Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. President Barack Obama has ordered an extensive reform of U.S. policies about dealing with hostage takers, and he pledged the government will use all instruments of national power to recover Americans being held prisoner abroad by terrorists. The government will no longer threaten to prosecute families who try to negotiate with kidnappers or pay ransom to win their relatives' release, Mr. Obama said Wednesday at the White House.
As I've gotten to know some of these families and heard some of these stories, it has been my solemn commitment to make sure that they feel fully supported in their efforts to get their families home.
Mr. Obama said the government will make no concessions to hostage takers and still opposes the payment for any ransoms. However, the president said this policy does not preclude engaging in communications with hostage takers. NATO's Secretary General says the alliance will not be forced into a Cold War-style arms race with Russia. Jens Stoltenberg told reporters in Brussels Wednesday that the alliance must upgrade its military capabilities in order to defend member states. Stoltenberg was speaking ahead of a meeting of NATO defense ministers in the Belgian capital. His comments followed the disclosure by U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter that the United States will pre-position about 250 tanks, along with other heavy weapons and military equipment, in six Eastern European NATO countries. Stoltenberg Wednesday said he supported the U.S. decision to pre-position weaponry and provide other forms of military assistance to the NATO members, which are located in the East. This is VOA News. French President Francois Hollande said he phoned U.S. President Barack Obama Wednesday to discuss allegations of U.S. eavesdropping on French leaders, and that Mr. Obama repeated promises to stop spying tactics considered unacceptable between allies. Obama made a similar pledge after Edward Snowden revealed the extent of U.S. National Security Agency's surveillance powers in 2013. The conversation took place after the whistleblower website WikiLeaks released documents Tuesday that it said showed the NSA had spied on former French President Jacques Chirac and Nicolas Sarkozy, as well as Mr. Hollande, from 2006 to 2012. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, joint operations by the Congolese Army and the United Nations mission MONUSCO have weakened one of the most active rebel groups in the country. The mission chief said Wednesday that about a quarter of the combatants with the FRPI rebel group have been taken out of action in the past 4 weeks. VOA's Nick Long has more.
The FRPI is a rebel group fighting for control of natural resources in Congo's Ituri province. The group was recently involved in a series of brutal civilian massacres and made itself a high-priority target for the Congolese army and the UN mission MONUSCO. The UN tried to persuade the FRPI to lay down its arms during talks at Aveba, but the negotiations broke down. The UN and the Congolese army stepped up their operations against the rebels, MONUSCO chief Martin Kobler told media Wednesday. He says the fighting on June the 3rd started after the FRPI had left the negotiating table and after they were offered the option of surrendering their weapons and coming under the UN's protection. But the MONUSCO chief stressed restoring the government's authority and providing jobs for young people are also key to reducing insecurity, he said. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Iran's constitutional watchdog has ratified legislation that requires the government to protect the country's nuclear rights as Iran and six world powers approach a deadline for reaching a comprehensive nuclear deal. State media reported the Guardian Council on Wednesday ratified the bill, which bans access to military sites and scientists. The FARS news agency quotes a council spokesman as saying the constitutional body passed the bill with a majority of votes and did not find it to contradict Islamic law or Iran's constitution. The United States has criticized China for carrying out state-sponsored cyber attacks, a blunt accusation that comes as authorities in Washington continue to investigate a massive hack into federal employee data. The Treasury Secretary Jack Lew made the comment Tuesday during the second day of high-level security and economic talks with Chinese officials. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up at this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The latest figures we have are that some 125,000 people have crossed so far this year from Turkey and North Africa into Greece and Italy.
That's William Spindler of the UN Refugee Agency talking about the flow of migrants and refugees to Europe. Details coming up.
Also, security officials say there was a targeted assassination attempt on the life of a United Arab Emirates diplomat today in Mogadishu. And survivors say a suicide bomber killed more than 10 people in a northeastern Nigeria village yesterday.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, survivors say a suicide bomber killed more than 10 people in a northeastern Nigeria village yesterday. Witnesses say the young female bomber blew herself up as she entered a market in Gojuba, a town once occupied by Boko Haram insurgents. The explosion, the second attack on the town in the same day, injured more than 20 bystanders. Northeast Nigeria has been a battleground between the Nigerian military and a violent six-year Boko Haram extremist effort to create a caliphate. The militaries of Chad, Cameroon, and Niger have joined the fight to defeat the extremists.
Hungary says it will suspend processing of asylum seekers registered within its border because a rising tide of refugees have overwhelmed the infrastructure. A government spokesman announced late yesterday that Hungary has informed its EU partners of the temporary suspension as the move runs contrary to EU regulations. It is not clear how other members of the EU bloc will react. Hungary's announcement refers to an agreement among EU members that asylum seekers may travel freely within the EU but must rely on the country they first entered to process their paperwork. Hungary has been hit hard by an uptick in asylum seekers in the past year. Last week, Hungarian officials announced a plan to build a 4-meter-high fence along 175 kilometers of the border with Serbia to stem the flow of illegal immigrants. Government figures show Hungarian police have apprehended more than 60,000 people so far this year who were trying to enter Hungary illegally, compared to about 43,000 for all of 2014.
While European countries debate what to do about the influx of refugees and migrants, there's no end in sight to those seeking safe haven from conflict or violence. They're traveling to Europe by either crossing the Mediterranean or landing on Greek islands. Just yesterday, 1,000 people were rescued on the Mediterranean by ships from Denmark and Norway. William Spindler is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the refugee crisis.
Conflicts in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere continue to push people to try to come to Europe through the Mediterranean, risking their lives in the process. And the latest figures we have are that some 125,000 people have crossed so far this year from Turkey and North Africa into Greece and Italy. The figure for Greece has just overtaken that for Italy. 63,000 people have arrived in Greece and some 62,000 have arrived in Italy. This is obviously very worrying because the communities where they are arriving are not prepared to deal with these large numbers of people arriving, and they are really struggling to cope, to provide them with assistance as they land, particularly in Greece, where they are arriving in small islands that are totally unprepared to deal with this large influx of refugees.
As you know, the European Union began its operation this week to try to target the boats of smugglers in the Mediterranean. Have you seen any evidence that this operation has had any effect on the flow of migrants and refugees, or is it too soon?
It's probably too soon to see any change in the patterns of people crossing by boat. From our point of view, any action that combats smuggling and the trafficking of human beings is to be welcomed, because smugglers are basically preying on vulnerable refugees and migrants and exploiting them, and in some cases endangering their lives and even killing them themselves. But our concern is that any action that combats smuggling has to preserve the lives and the safety and the welfare of the victims of the smugglers, in other words, the refugees. And also, it's very important these people have still access to safety in Europe and the possibility to claim asylum from persecution. This is something that needs to be preserved. So although we welcome actions against smugglers, we want protection for their victims, i.e. the innocent refugees and migrants that are forced to use the services of the smugglers.
You've mentioned that the migrants and refugees were increasing on the Greek islands. Has Greece become the route of choice? In other words, are we seeing the same ethnic makeup through Greece as we have seen of those crossing the Mediterranean?
The nationalities of the people crossing into Greece are slightly different from those crossing from Libya into Italy. On the central Mediterranean route from Libya into southern Italy, you see a majority of people from sub-Saharan Africa, countries such as Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, some people from West Africa. There are also some Syrians, but they are not the majority. On the route from Turkey into Greece, on the other hand, you see a majority of Syrians. About 60% of those who arrive are from Syria. You also see a large number of Afghans, Iraqis, and other people fleeing conflict in the Middle East. Nearly 90% of the people landing in Greece are coming from countries experiencing conflict or human rights violations.
What are your concerns about those who reach Europe? Is there any plan that is now in effect that deals with the folks that have been registered by the UNHCR and go on to other countries?
Well, our concern is that faced with this large influx of refugees, many European countries are simply shutting their borders and becoming more restrictive or in allowing people to enter, and in some cases even building walls and fences. And in our view, this is not the solution. It's precisely in moments like this that Europe has to remember its values. And also, it's important to realize that Europe cannot simply hide behind walls. We need to deal with this problem. There is a collective international responsibility to deal with this situation, because Europe's security and welfare and prosperity are linked to what happens in the rest of the world. Europe cannot be an island of security, peace, and stability when all around it you have conflict. We need to address the root causes of why people are fleeing, and that has to do with conflict and with lack of development in many parts of Africa and the Middle East. And the international community needs to be more active in solving and preventing conflict. And it's something that in the past Europe has managed to do. We also think that it's very important to create legal avenues for people who want to come to Europe, either for economic reasons and, more importantly, for those who are escaping war and persecution, so that they don't risk their lives in this way. If we look into the possibilities of family reunification, if we look also at the possibility of resettlement from other countries, humanitarian admission programs, and so on, we will ensure that those who come in a safe, orderly, organized way. In that way, countries that receive them will be prepared, and these people will not be risking their lives unnecessarily.
William Spindler is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Security officials say there was a targeted assassination attempt on the life of a United Arab Emirates diplomat today in the Somali capital Mogadishu. The attack failed. A pickup truck exploded when it rammed a military escort vehicle from the UN mission to Somalia, killing 12 people. The armored Land Rover carrying the diplomat was not damaged. Al-Shabaab declared the bombing was an attempt to kill a foreign enemy. Somalia has been racked by instability since the collapse of Siad Barre's regime in 1991.
Coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Insults flew in South Africa's parliament yesterday as members debated the government's decision to not arrest Sudan's president on an international genocide warrant during his recent visit. The debate exposed not only the different opinions about the government's actions, but also the deep acrimony that has lately come to define South African politics. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
More than 90 minutes into the debate, South African lawmakers were still launching angry verbal assaults on President Jacob Zuma and on each other. The bitterness was perhaps best expressed by opposition politician Musiwa Lekota.
The leadership, President Zuma and his cabinet, and those who colluded with this thing, do not deserve to lead us. They have failed to uphold the constitution of our land. The oaths you made mean nothing. You lied to us. You said you'd uphold the constitution, uphold the law, and be the example. You have misled the people of our country. And now we are ashamed before the nations of the world.
Peter Mulder, another opposition party leader, said he thought this was the worst scandal the nation has seen in a while.
Sir, forget about FIFA. The al-Bashir crisis makes the FIFA version look like a Sunday school picnic.
Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges that he masterminded a genocide in Sudan's Darfur region, where his government has been fighting rebels since 2003. He has denied the charges. The Sudanese president is long gone after briefly touching down in Johannesburg for an African Union summit earlier this month. But the government's decision to not arrest him has snowballed into a huge issue in South Africa, especially given that officials ignored a court order that sought to keep him in the country. The government has argued that Mr. Bashir enjoyed diplomatic immunity as a summit attendee. The ruling African National Congress Party defended the decision during Tuesday's debate, saying the ICC unfairly prosecutes Africans. The party has also suggested that the nation consider withdrawing from the court. Here's Minister of Small Business Lindiwe Zulu, who has also served as Mr. Zuma's special advisor on international relations.
Honorable Speaker, can these members really think we are going to arrest a head of state? They must think again.
The ANC found an unlikely ally in this argument in the Economic Freedom Fighters. The rowdy, youth-centric EFF party has harangued Mr. Zuma for the use of government funds to upgrade his private home. But EFF member Floyd Shivambu backed the ANC on this issue and said South Africa would have created a crisis by arresting Mr. Bashir.
And also it was naive for the whoever took the government to court to think that it can be wise to arrest a head of state here in South Africa. It was going to lead to instability in the origin country where he came from. It was going to even threaten our security in South Africa.
The most heated part of the debate came as Deputy Justice Minister John Jeffrey discussed the legal issues raised by the court order and took a shot at opposition Chief Whip John Steenhuisen.
Now, Deputy Speaker, without making any comment on the circumstances of President Bashir's departure, what would have happened? Because it is still before the courts, you idiot. I withdraw that.
Point of order.
I withdraw that.
Hello. Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry, the Honourable Member can't just make a statement that is derogatory to another member and then just simply say, I withdraw. Speaker, Deputy Speaker, you cannot have a member in this House calling another member an idiot.
And on that bitter note, the debate ended. But this argument, and with it South Africa's political divide, is far from over. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Over the past 21 years, there's been a huge drop in the number of African lions. The International Union for Conservation of Nature reports that the lion population has been reduced by 42% during that period. The Animal Welfare and Conservation Organization, Born Free USA, is calling for immediate international action to halt what it calls catastrophic declines. Adam M. Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA. He says their research attributes the disappearance of lions to a number of factors.
Born Free's research over a number of years has shown that the decline of lions across Africa is really from myriad factors. You obviously have habitat decline as humans compete with wild animals for portions of the landscape, but then you also have disease that runs through wildlife populations. But I think probably the most prevalent problem for Africa's lions is the human-caused influences from poaching. It could be retaliatory killing for lions who have killed livestock and as a result are either speared or rather gruesomely poisoned in retaliation. And then you have human trophy hunters, which is especially problematic for American trophy hunters, taking literally hundreds and hundreds of lions each year simply for a so-called sport. And when you put all of these factors together, you really find that there's a problematic situation that's imperiling the species across the continent.
Why is the lion population decline in southern Africa not as significant as it is elsewhere in Africa?
Well, I think the first thing when you explore sort of the different levels of decline across the continent that you have to do is sort of understand the dynamics. And when you look at the sheer numbers, you realize that the levels of decline or the rates of decline may not be as profound in certain southern African countries as elsewhere, but you're still dealing with a rather small population across the continent. So when you're dealing with perhaps 32,000 lions across Africa, knowing that there may be 10,000 in South Africa, but only say 1,000 or 1,200 in Ethiopia isn't such a stark difference. But I think it's sheer issues of money and resources and the availability of habitat protection and wildlife conservation efforts. South Africa obviously has the biggest and most booming economy across the continent, and so surely one would expect them to have more resources being put into conservation. But that doesn't, of course, mean that there aren't problems in those southern African countries where poaching is pronounced. And in South Africa, you have this compounding problem of lions being bred in captivity and then being sold around the world, which creates a problem for everyone when these lions get sold into the pet trade or for their bones in Asia. You end up with lions in Ethiopia, in Kenya, and elsewhere being poached from the wild and smuggled in for that same purpose. So it's really a continent-wide problem, not just a problem between, say, North and South.
What type of action then is needed to protect the lion population in Africa?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is recognize that there's a global responsibility to protect lions. It's not just about what individual African governments are doing or are capable of doing. Born Free has been instrumental, for example, in working with the Convention on Migratory Species to recognize the threats to lions and the need to have cross-boundary protections put in to protect the species. As well, we were part of a group of organizations in 2011 that petitioned the U.S. Department of the Interior to list the lion as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, which would drastically reduce the number of trophies that are coming into America and ensure that America could play a vital positive role in the conservation of the species across Africa. And we're still waiting for a final decision from the Fish and Wildlife Service about the status of the lion under the ESA, but that would be a pronounced positive impact if we could get lions so listed. And then, of course, there's the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, that can take great responsibility for increasing the level of protection for lions and therefore decreasing the number of lions that are allowed to be commercially traded globally. So we really need an integrated global approach to ensuring that Africa's lions exist in perpetuity.
You mentioned earlier about the loss of the habitat. How does this loss of habitat affect how lions hunt and eat?
So as humans integrate themselves into the wild landscape, it actually has a significant impact on the behavior of lions and their ability to exist in the ecosystem in which they've obviously thrived for a very long time. One of the most profound ways that happens is that as humans expand their settlements into wild habitat, you have a decreasing availability of habitat for lions, which then results in the lions perhaps changing their diet patterns from wild animals, including antelope, for example, and starting to prey more and more on different species, but also the human livestock. And that creates that human-lion conflict that has significantly negative consequences for lions wherever that happens. So the more that we don't protect lions in the wild where they belong, the more conflict you're going to have and the greater the threat on the species.
Adam Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, many teachers are paid months late if they are paid at all. In remote areas, teachers' salaries are distributed by the Catholic Church-run organization Caritas, which some politicians and teachers suggest is not apt to the task. But as Nick Long reports from Goma, Caritas defends its record and says the real problems lie elsewhere.
In the last session of the DRC Parliament, which ended on June the 15th, opposition lawmaker Fabien Mutom called for an urgent parliamentary inquiry into what he called grey areas around government workers' pay. Among those grey areas, he suggested, were the details of the government's contract with the Catholic organisation Caritas, which distributes the salaries of state school teachers in parts of the country without banks. Mutom recommended handing back that responsibility to local government. A spokesman for the teachers' union in Goma, Jean-Luc Ndayelitse, told VOA teachers are dissatisfied with Caritas's performance.
Nous avons des propositions.
We have two propositions, he says. Either Caritas improves its service so that teachers are paid on time, or Caritas must give up the contract with the government and allow the government to relaunch banks where teachers can be paid. Most teachers paid through the Caritas office in Goma have not been paid for the past 2 months, says Ndayelitse.
Oui, nous avons, par exemple, le territoire de Rutshuru.
For example, he says in Rutshuru and Lubero territories, teachers still have not been paid for December and January because Caritas's vehicle was held up by bandits, and they've also not been paid for April and May, which makes 4 months arrears. A Caritas spokesman in Goma, Abbe Arsène Masumbuko, told VOA the delays are not Caritas's fault.
Alors, les arriérés s'expliquent facilement.
He says the arrears are easily explained as the money can be held up between the government and Caritas's national headquarters in Kinshasa because sometimes there are administrative problems. The main problem, he told VOA, is disagreements over who should cover the high transport costs, the government or Caritas. In North Kivu, insecurity is the main reason for the high cost. Caritas used to transport the money by road to the many Catholic parishes where it was collected by school directors. But in some areas, this is no longer possible and the money has to go by air.
Alors, Walikale, c'est tout un problème parce que je vous dis, il n'y a que ces deux voies.
North Kivu's most remote territory, Walikale, is a real problem, says Masumbuko. He says Caritas was counting on using UN mission planes for Walikale, but the UN mission refused, and it is difficult to use commercial flights as they land 25 kilometers from Walikale's main town, which is a security risk. In the past year and a half, Caritas in Goma lost $130,000 when one of its vehicles carrying teacher pay was ambushed, and another of these vehicles was chased by bandits who may also have stolen teacher pay.
Le même militaire qui est soupçonné pour le premier braquage est celui-là qui nous a poursuivi.
Abbe Masumbuko says the same army officer who is suspected of committing the first of those robberies also chased the second vehicle to a parish and threatened Caritas staff. He added that the army officer has been removed from his post but has not been put on trial. Despite his criticisms of Caritas, Ndayelitse says the organisation does a far better job of getting money to teachers than the government managed in the past. Previously, he said, teachers received only about 70% of their salaries, and the rest was deducted by the administrative hierarchy, but now they receive nearly all of their salaries. Besides many teachers being paid late, many are not paid at all in DRC. Ndayelitse said about 30% of teachers at state schools receive no salary from the government. The local education authority in Goma said locally it was more like 45%, as many new schools have been opening and their staff are not yet on the government payroll. Ruth Habimana was an unpaid teacher for several years before she resigned. They often promised us we would be paid, she says, and when a year had gone by, they said, you'll be paid next year. And the years passed like that. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Youssef of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.